Lecture 23, Asian Empires and a Shogunate.
Our focus in this discussion is on Asian societies during the early modern period. Frankly, it's a presumptuous combination. This is a huge territory with all sorts of different societies that experienced all sorts of different developments during this long period. But a few generalizations are possible, and they will help round out our understanding of what was going on during these interesting centuries. One of the first things to emphasize is the extent to which attention, even brief, to Asian developments in the early modern period needs to fight longstanding prejudices and stereotypes. Many of my students, who sometimes don't seem to know a lot about world history when they come into my class, nevertheless do know that China was isolated, China was conservative, and this set of characteristics seems to dominate some impressions of China, at least before recent times. This was a period in which most Asian societies were actively engaged in wider connections in the world on different terms from those that operated in Western Europe, to be sure, but actively engaged. This was not, in the main, an isolationist period. This was not a period of economic retrenchment. And the necessity of confronting some of these misimpressions head-on is one of the crucial reasons to deal with this wide-ranging topic in a specific session. We'll return at the end to the question of why it's so important to rectify the record, and many world historians have actively contributed to this task. There were two big developments, again, trying to look at the big picture with regard to a number of different societies. Two big developments in Asian societies during the early modern period. The first, which we already touched on in dealing with the absolute necessity of modifying the world economy approach where Asia is concerned, the first development was increasing prosperity, at least for some groups, as a result of Asia's participation in producing for world markets and receiving goods, including American silver, in exchange. As we noted, a number of Asian societies were significantly altered by this growing commercialization. Merchants gained new roles. Money use gained new roles. Governments gained access to additional resources themselves. So this participation in global patterns, yielding, again, at least selective prosperity, was a significant development in its own right, confirming, among other things, an interest in export-based manufacture in parts of China, an interest in transmission to world markets in parts of India, etc. The second development, which we've also mentioned but not fully fleshed out, was the emergence of a series of gunpowder empires in much of the Asian landmass. We will also be dealing today with a somewhat separate set of developments in Japan, which don't quite fit the gunpowder empire model. But the emergence of a number of quite solid empires operating over a considerable period of time is a really interesting set of parallelisms in Asian history during this period. The new empires were three in number, in addition, of course, to Russia, which itself established a significant Asian presence during this period. The new empires were three in number. First came the Ottomans. The Ottoman Empire began to take shape in the middle of the 15th century. It's one of the factors that helped launch the early modern period. It extended its hold over much of southeastern Europe, including at the high point, even Hungary. It developed significant holdings in much of the Middle East, though not all of it. It extended its direct control to Egypt and had some nominal control over other parts of North Africa, though not Morocco. This was a major and, in fact, long-lasting empire. It outlived the Roman Empire, among other things, if you just count years. The second empire to emerge, also extremely important, this one developing in the early 16th century, was the Mughal Empire in India. The Mughal Empire was formed as a result of invasions from a force that operated through Afghanistan. Early Mughal emperors were extremely interested in establishing a solidly based imperial structure in India. They were frequently extremely intelligent. They were interested in new ideas. They were eager to combine traditional Indian practices with new elements. They were explicitly extremely tolerant in religion. They utilized Hindus as well as Muslims in administration. This was a rich period in Indian history under Mughal control. Here, too, the empire expanded considerably territorially. It never controlled the entire Indian subcontinent, but it did command an increasing chunk in north and central India and even attempted, to some extent, to reach south. The third great gunpowder empire, though a smaller one, was the Safavid Empire in Persia, which helped revive a sense of Persian identity and presence. Still Muslim, there was no overall cultural change here. This empire had a significant existence for a couple of centuries. China, of course, operated according to a somewhat different rhythm because here the imperial tradition was well established. And much of the early modern period saw the operation of the Ming Dynasty, established a bit before the early modern period. But as we've noted briefly before, the second dynasty of the early modern period, and in fact what turned out to be China's last dynasty, had a few elements of gunpowder empire attached to it as well. This final dynasty, the Qing, formerly known as the Manchu, was organized by Manchurians coming in from northern China. And while they adopted Chinese institutional patterns and culture in many ways, they remained partially outsiders in their own estimation and in that of the Chinese. So there was in China as well an element that was not dissimilar to the other gunpowder empires, involving an intrusion from outside, helping to shape the imperial experience more generally. These empires had significant accomplishments. It is obviously valid to note, as for example Chinese observers have in looking back at this period, it is obviously valid to note that the developments that occurred under the gunpowder and Chinese empires were not overall quite as dynamic as those occurring in Western Europe. Asian power began relatively to decline a little bit if measured against European power. For example, by 1700, European technologies in metallurgy and in some branches of textile production were now probably superior to their Asian counterparts. Not yet massively superior, but a balance that had been so long-standing in world history, in which technological leadership and innovation centered in Asia, particularly East Asia, and tended to move westward. This balance during the early modern period was beginning to shift toward greater Western parity and even slight leadership, a shift that would obviously be compounded in the later 18th and 19th centuries. So, in talking about the achievements of the gunpowder empires, the developments in Asia in this period, both economic and political, it is important to note, at risk of encouraging stereotype, which is not my goal, it is important to note that there was a certain shift in balance, and Asian developments, in terms of sheer power politics and economic dynamism, were not quite keeping pace with some of the leading patterns in Europe. Still, the gunpowder empires had significant achievements to their credit. Some textbook approaches mention the gunpowder empires and then race to their decline, and we'll have to talk about their decline, at least in part, as a late early modern phenomenon as well. But the achievements need to be noted in addition. The Ottoman Empire brought a number of developments to the Middle East and Southeastern Europe. They obviously helped solidify and highlight a new Turkish presence in the northern Middle East, the fruit of migration as well as political control. But it was equally important to note that Ottoman administration was never purely Turkish. It admixed a number of other peoples, including non-Muslims, in a tradition that actually had been well established in earlier periods in the Middle East. The Ottoman Empire helped encourage the spread of Islamic belief to a significant minority of people in parts of southeastern Europe. Christian groups were tolerated. For the most part, though there were some forced conversions of a group of young military people seized as part of the Ottoman military force, the Janissaries. But the changes in the religious map in southeastern Europe were noteworthy, as well as some new antagonisms that seemed to spring up around Ottoman control. Ottoman relationships with Arabs also deserve attention. While the Ottoman Empire used individual Arabs, as well as Christians and Jews, in administration, on the whole, the Ottoman Empire confirmed a somewhat dependent and inferior political status for Arabs, whom many Turks looked down on to some extent, and that pattern has to be factored in to developments in the Middle East, even to contemporary times as well. The Ottoman Empire introduced significant cultural changes into the Middle East. A form of mosque developed, best illustrated by some of the great mosques of Istanbul and its environs, that blended actually Byzantine architectural forms with Muslim needs, an interesting innovation. Ottoman contributions to literature and art, often in Arabic, were also significant. Political, some religious, and cultural achievements then left a lasting mark on the Middle East, even as the Ottoman hold would begin to decline. Mughal contributions to India, again, numerous. At its high point, a system of considerable tolerance and intermixture of Hindus and Muslims was a contribution, though unfortunately not an entirely lasting one. Mughal cultural contributions were really major. The Mughals helped further Persian artistic influence in India, leading to new forms of portraiture. The Mughals were also interested in receiving some Western cultural influences, not deep ones, but influences that affected a style of portrait painting and even dress in the upper classes in Mughal India. Much of what we rate as Indian cuisine today dates from the Mughal period. In other words, the Mughals introduced significant cultural richness into the Indian tradition, as well as, of course, important individual symbols like the great Taj Mahal. The Mughals also, arguably, furthered a sense not of Indian unity, but of the possibility of creating larger territorial units in the Indian subcontinent, which, of course, the British would pick up and then which would feed directly into considerable Indian unity after the British rule passed. This was a contribution worth noting. And the Mughals also developed administrative and taxation structures that would have long impact in India, again, even after the Mughals themselves departed. Mughals were even interested, although this one didn't take, in reforming certain other traditional Indian practices, for example, the practice of sati, which they disapproved of but didn't ultimately have quite the clout to attack directly. Developments in Safavid Persia, again, included a revival of a sense of Persian identity. It was under the Safavid Empire that Farsi was established as the dominant language of the region, as it still is today in Iran. Again, cultural developments that go beyond the mere fact of stating the existence of an empire. And developments in Qing China included, again, significant participation in economic prosperity, the re-elaboration of the bureaucratic imperial state. Significant population expansion occurred under the very late Ming and the Qing dynasty. Again, this was a pattern of developments of considerable importance. It is vital then to recognize that during much of the early modern period, largely if not entirely independent of Western influence in any cultural or political sense, Asian kingdoms, Asian empires were establishing significant achievements that would have marks, that would leave marks that outlasted the empires themselves. It is also true, however, that some of the gunpowder empires began to show signs of wear as early as the late 17th, early 18th centuries, though here the pattern is varied and we need to be careful of oversimple generalizations. The Safavid Empire began to weaken in the early 18th century. The Mughal Empire began to weaken even somewhat earlier. Later 17th Mughal emperors made what, in retrospect, it seems were two clear mistakes if the goal was to preserve Indian vitality and Mughal rule itself. In the first place, several later emperors began to reverse the policy of religious tolerance, began clearly to favor Muslims in administration, began in some instances to attack Hindu religious shrines, and began to create an atmosphere of religious mistrust that would continue to affect Indian history, be exacerbated by aspects of British rule in ways that obviously have contemporary implications as well. The second mistake, if this kind of historical judgment is permitted, the second mistake was quite simply an effort at overexpansion. The attempt to press Mughal boundaries southward led to significant military expenditure, the amassing of vast armies, including elephant forces, sometimes successful, but at real expense to the taxation base and indeed the basic economic vitality of India as a whole. By the 18th century, Mughal hold over India was beginning to fade in favor of local princes, the revival of that tradition of localism so frequent in Indian politics. Indian economic prosperity was declining. Indian cultural and educational apparatus was in some disarray as well. And of course, it was in this context, late 17th, but particularly 18th centuries, that European powers, ultimately headed by the English, began to interfere increasingly successfully in Indian affairs. The British, and particularly the British East India Company, was able to take advantage of growing Mughal weakness to establish a growing British beachhead in the continent itself. The British were able to develop alliances with other Indian rulers, hostile to each other or hostile to the Mughals, that furthered British rule without the commitment of vast forces. The later 18th century saw the increasing conversion of much of India to essentially a British colony, a huge change, obviously, in Indian history, a huge expansion of European imperial presence taking shape at the end of the early modern period. The Ottoman Empire presents a different picture, although Europeans sometimes tried to argue that it wasn't as different as might seem. The Ottoman Empire undoubtedly reached a high point in the late 16th and 17th centuries. A last effort at territorial expansion occurred in the 1680s as Ottoman troops twice attacked Vienna, hoping to press farther into Central Europe. These attacks failed, and from that point onward, the Ottomans suffered a periodic series of territorial setbacks, partly at the hands of Austro-Hungarians, who pressed the empire back from the Habsburg territories, but even more at the hands of the Russians in patterns that we discussed in our previous session. Ottoman territorial setbacks obviously pressed the empire in other ways. It became harder to reward loyal top bureaucrats and generals. Many parts of the empire became increasingly parceled out among chief administrators who might milk the province for personal advantage. Corruption and economic dislocation increased. But the Ottoman Empire was still, in many ways, quite healthy and would remain healthy well into the 19th century. It wasn't as vibrant as it had been before. On the other hand, in no sense was it on its last legs. But there was one further development that was interesting as well. By the 18th century, sensing Ottoman weakness and also undoubtedly exploiting an older prejudice against Islam, European opinion began to decide that the Ottoman rule was both sick and weak. And this European impression that this was an empire cruel to its subjects, cruel to women, but also on its last legs, was a perception that would create a reality of its own during the 19th century and affect Europe's relations with the Middle East in its own right. Developments in China, much more complex. In most respects, in fundamental respects, the Chinese state and economy remained quite vigorous up until the 1830s. For example, it was only in the 1830s and 40s that the European balance of payments situation vis-a-vis China finally altered so that Europe began to be able to take precious metals from China rather than paying them in return for Chinese goods. But there were some signs. They were modest. This is a state that's still vigorous and successful. There were some signs of trouble. Probably by the 18th century, China was beginning to be burdened by overpopulation, fed by new food supplies, an overpopulation that could require so many resources to sustain itself that it would affect larger economic dynamism and economic growth. Certainly, China ceased being, even apart from its relative position vis-a-vis Europe, China ceased being a source of major technological innovation at this point. There's some sense as well that cultural creativity lagged somewhat. Chinese intellectuals were still vigorously reproducing earlier literary forms and discussing Confucian traditions. This was not a cultural collapse, but new influences, new interpretations of older themes probably declined somewhat. The empire may also have been affected by excessive bureaucratization, excessive levels of paperwork that made decision-making difficult, that made communication with the provinces sometimes cumbersome. Again, none of this would come home to roost still for several decades, but in retrospect, we can see some possible signs of trouble. One thing is clear, particularly with regard to China and the Ottoman Empire. A possible source of renewal, which Russia was pursuing, albeit amid complexity, as we discussed in our previous session, a possible source of renewal was not pursued, and that was the possibility of selectively looking at developments in the West as a pattern for certain kinds of possible reforms. China, in fact, which had been open to modest Western missionary activity in much of the early modern period, which had been interested as somewhat of a curiosity, but a bit more than that, in Western developments such as clocks and other scientific discoveries, Chinese openness to even modest Western presence definitely turned sour in the early 18th century, with increasing restrictions on missionaries, persecutions of small groups of Chinese Christians. This was not a path that China chose to take. Participation in trade remained vigorous, but there was, if anything, a retreat from an interest in contacts of other sorts. The Ottoman Empire, which was even more aware of developments in the West because individual Ottomans traveled frequently to Western Europe, there was no barrier of communication here at all. The Ottoman Empire also rather systematically avoided the possibility of influential contacts with the West. For example, the printing press, which had obviously been established in Western Europe long since, the printing press was banned from the Ottoman Empire until toward the middle of the 18th century, when it was first allowed only for Christians, not for Muslims. And the reason, obviously, was not just blanket rejection of the West. The reason, obviously, was a government desire to make sure as possible, that it had control over access to information and ideology. Gradually, this was loosened, but pretty late in the game. The only Western influence that was directly incorporated by Ottoman rulers, interestingly enough, were Western doctors who were called upon to service the Ottoman court, even though, as far as one can determine, they were no more effective in actual medical practice than were the physicians in the rich traditions of the Middle East, a sort of cultural fad that had no clear practical basis. We have then a situation in the great states of Asia in which during most of the early modern period, significant vigor developed, significant achievements were registered, but in a pattern in which gains were somewhat overshadowed, as we now know, by the greater vigor of developments in the West. And we have a situation where markedly to tentatively, certain signs of absolute decline begin to show as well. There's one final case that deserves attention that actually, to some extent, interestingly contrasts with the gunpowder empire developments we've been emphasizing thus far. The early modern period was a crucial one in Japanese history. As we've discussed previously, after some flirtation with Western contacts, Japanese leaders decided at the end of the 16th century largely to close off contacts, not entirely, but largely, and emphasize a pattern of internal economic, political, and cultural development. This was the period that becomes known as the Tokugawa Shogunate, which would last until 1868. Under the Tokugawa Shogunate, feudalism persisted. The ritual apparatus of feudalism was carefully preserved along with the social privileges of feudal lords. But alongside feudalism, and in fact more effective than feudalism, began to be the apparatus of a small but definite central state, serviced by its own bureaucracy, not feudal vassals, and capable of reducing, in most cases, eliminating internal warfare, providing increasing political unity, which was in turn the framework for the rather successful expansion of commercial activity within Japan that we have discussed before. This was obviously a significant and, as it turned out, fairly durable political change in Japanese affairs that marked increasing political effectiveness and a de facto modification of feudalism that was quite significant. Cultural change accompanied this development as well. Even though Japan's intense interactions with China were things of the past, the Japanese actually, during this early modern period, turned increasingly toward Confucianism. Buddhism survived and could be vigorous in some instances. The more traditional religion of Shintoism survived as well, though it probably faded somewhat. But cultural emphasis shifted increasingly to a Japanese version of Confucianism that had two consequences that would be significant for the future as well. Consequence number one was simply an increasing secularization of Japanese culture. Not an entire secularization, but as Confucianism spread, this worldly concerns began to predominate in Japanese culture, along, by the way, with some interesting new artistic forms that would mark further steps in Japanese cultural identity as well. The second implication of the Japanese version of Confucianism, though it became fully clear only in the first half of the 19th century, was an increasing commitment to the importance of education, not just for a Confucian upper class, but for broader bands of society and what we would call the middle classes and even somewhat below. Japanese Confucianism ended up, not immediately, but over time, ended up encouraging an educational commitment that would lead Japan to be the second society after that of the West in literacy rates by the early 19th century, a very interesting pattern that, again, reflects considerable cultural dynamism in Japan itself. These patterns in Japan obviously differed from those in other parts of East Asia, particularly China. The shogunate emphasized a growing importance of the central state, but feudalism was still quite real. Japanese version of Confucianism was somewhat distinctive, particularly in its ultimate educational emphasis. Japanese population policy, or Japanese population behavior, was also somewhat distinctive. During the 18th century, Japanese population did not grow massively, did not overcome available resources, as was beginning to be suggested in China. A fairly extensive use of abortion, among other things, seems to have limited Japanese population growth. And most interestingly of all for the future, the Japanese in the 18th century began to become slightly more open to outside influence rather than less. Decisions were made to exploit the contacts with Dutch merchants and what was called the Dutch School of Translators in Japan, people who learned Dutch in order to have the capability of interaction with the Europeans. This contact was exploited to allow the translation of scientific and medical works into Japanese, not other works yet, but an indication that the Japanese were sufficiently aware of what was going on in the outside world, that they saw that there was a need to take at least some opportunity to figure out what these developments might portend for Japan itself. The patterns that we've been discussing don't overturn conventional views of Asian history in the early modern period entirely. Again, relative decline is undeniable as long as it doesn't overwhelm an understanding that there were important positive developments during much of this period. Asia was not simply sitting around waiting for Western control and guidance. This was a series of independent kingdoms capable of significant achievements. Specific decline of specific regimes, most notably in Mughal India, has to be registered as well. But the larger sense that somehow this was a crucial period in which Asia began to be backward, isolated, whatever the term, this sense is simply wrong. Which leads to one final question. Why care? World historians, particularly experts on Asia and the world economy, have vigorously insisted that we need to redress this impression of Asian economic inferiority, backwardness, etc. And I think the reasons are twofold. One is, presumably, it's better to be accurate than not. And when we have knowledge of things like Chinese acquisition of New World silver, we need to exploit it because otherwise we're simply pandering to error. And I guess I would argue that in itself is a bad thing. But point two, we need to redress this impression because it so panders to older Western prejudices about Asian characteristics. It reflects a very brief sense of Western superiority. If we realize that Asia remained a vital contributor to world history up until at least the 18th and even into the 19th centuries, and then would again become a vital contributor to world history by the 20th century, the period of Asian eclipse, if that's even an appropriate term, is very brief indeed. And this we have to know, whatever our views about historical accuracy, as a means of understanding Western-Asian relations and Asian concerns about Western opinion, even in the present day.